Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me again is my co-host, Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the theatrical release of The Phantom Tollbooth, directed by Chuck Jones and based on the novel by Norton Juster with illustrations by Jules Pfeiffer. This came out on, I'm going to get this date wrong, the 7th of November in 1970. And at the time, the New York Times said that it was, quote, yummy, unquote, as its almost final word in the review. It was funny, clever, melodious, with seven spanking good tunes, ditto the lyrics, and altogether enjoyable. Anna, what did you think of it? Do you agree with the New York Times that you just want to gobble it up, or did you find that it is perhaps a part of 70s culture that is justifiably forgotten?
I think that there's probably two different perspectives, if not more, on this movie. I found it to be a bit of a yawner.
That is a phrase I'm enjoying hearing coined for the first time.
Falling asleep twice trying to watch it on consecutive days. But I think there's different audiences that would enjoy this. I think that kids could like it. And I also think that a film aficionado could really get a lot out of this. It's a beautiful period piece. It really has a lot of groovy 60s qualities. But I think that your average viewer is not going to love this movie.
Well, then let's approach it from a couple of different perspectives then, since you say that it could potentially appeal. Let's start with why you think this would or wouldn't work for kids.
Well, I think probably a lot of kids are going to be baffled by some of the content. I think that what probably did work in the book in terms of the wordplay doesn't often carry over well into the movie.
This is a book you have or haven't read?
I have not read it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, published originally in 1961, based on an original concept by Juster. There's a 2011 documentary called Phantom Tollbooth Beyond Expectations that was kickstarted on the 50th anniversary of the publication of the novel that talks about how it's very unusual for children's books, particularly, to not be engineered without the direct, I don't want to say interference, but that's the first word that sprang to mind, the direct influence of an editor. But this happened because Juster was putting off and trying not to write his day job, which was a book about architecture. And in avoidance of that, he ended up putting together this whimsical creation. And the movie came out in 1970, almost 10 years later. It is a book, as you say, about wordplay. And yet somebody thought, oh, I know, let's take a book about words and concepts and let's do a bunch of pictures about it. That seems like a natural idea. Do you think that that was kind of a silly idea from the start?
I don't know. I mean,
well, what's a children's movie that you do like? What's one of the formative children's movies that you had on VHS and went back to again and again?
The only VHS tape that I had growing up was Old Yeller, so which probably says a lot about why I just block things out. Actually, so when I was watching this movie, it really made me appreciate Disney movies, which I think are really, you know, say what you will about Disney, and I think there's a lot there. Disney tends to have really well-crafted and approachable movies that kids really love, that at lots of different ages, kids can sort of, you know, walk up to and get something out of a Disney movie and really love for a long time. And that may or may not be true for this movie. I know that I read some articles, you know, describing how it didn't get a fair shake from the, you know, distribution company. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's, you know, some criticisms there. But as far as I'm concerned, I think that, you know, Disney designs a story, sort of unfolds a story in a really compelling way, in a way that this did not. And I think that the wordplay is probably part of that. Also, the really blunt force moralizing. You know, I think most movies, most kids' movies sort of have a moral tone at, to some degree or other. any fairy tale sort of has like a warning like woven into it, but this story only has a moral tone to it, like that's the whole plot, and it was annoying from the get-go. And I don't know if I don't know if a kid would necessarily feel that way. I think probably as a kid I was open to like all kinds of propaganda that I am more sensitive to as a grown-up. I don't know, what did you think about that?
Well, I just want to, before we get into my feelings, I want to drill down into a couple of examples for anybody who might not have seen the movie or read the book. So the story starts off with our boy Milo, a young toe-headed kid played by actor Butch Patrick, who had played Eddie Munster on The Munsters starting in 1964. But here he's without his trademark widow-peaked wig and instead is a sort of freckle-faced kid slumping around San Francisco. And the movie opens with a montage of different facts and things that somebody might be told in school. And a series of kids like standing up and volunteering, but adult voices talking about all the different things that are important. And I have a partial list here. William Shakespeare, The Discovery of America by Christopher Columbus. There's a dated reference. E equals MC squared. Carry the three, the Fibonacci sequence, DNA, and Einstein. And then everyone excitedly is dismissed and goes out, and Milo just wanders through the streets of San Francisco back to his apartment while I still don't have a good feeling as to like what's the right musical artist to associate with the soundtrack, but the opening Where Do You Go, Milo song has such lyrics as, he looks at life but he doesn't see. Milo, you need to see how amazing life can be. That I think that's where it zooms in very quickly on your first impressions that this is a didactic polemic about how you need to live your life. And does that syrupy sweet mamas and the papas moralizing just not even something you can come to grips with? It's just really sets your teeth on edge right from the beginning?
Yeah. I would say it was probably that opening scene, but it gets no better.
The opening action is after going through a little monologue on the phone with his best friend, Ralph.
Hello, Ralph.
Hi, Milo.
Who calls him even before he gets home. And he answers the phone and says, hi, Ralph, without, like, there's no caller ID. This is 1970. He just knows that this is a phone call and that he and his best friend, Ralph, who Chuck Jones describes as a kid with the name Ralph is somebody who feels like a wet shoe, is calling him basically to complain about how bored they are.
Are you doing anything?
I'm not doing anything. What's there to do?
Nothing, I guess. Nothing is fun anymore.
Right. Everything's a big waste of time.
This is their... Mom goes into the kitchen, pours herself a glass of wine, puts two ice cubes in it, and complains about the day. Milo and Ralph get home from school and talk about how dull everything is. That's their processing at the end of the day. They're not going to do anything except lie on the couch and go... And so his parents will probably eventually come home and make him hang up the phone. But until that point...
Potentially an important moment... For latchkey kids.
Yeah. And he has the run of the city. He wanders through Chinatown. He takes the trolley, all for a, you know, roughly 11-year-old boy. You know, seems to be pretty independent. But the song and the opening titles are showing us other kids want to play basketball. They want to show off their fireworks. You know, they're petting goats. They're having a grand old time. There are fire trucks. He just wanders past all of these brightly colored, massive industrial and personal opportunities as a human slump.
Everybody says it's such a big, wonderful world. How come it seems so small and kind of empty?
And that's supposed to be the tension of the film, is what would make Milo energized? So when a magical candy-striped box shows up in his bedroom, he opens it up, a toll booth appears, gives him a magic car and sends him through, and he suddenly becomes a cartoon character. And this is when the soundtrack and the actor himself start to wake up. And did you go, okay, this could be a Who Framed Roger Rabbit fun, live-action cartoon adventure, or were you still like, meh?
I found the pacing to be such that I was not particularly drawn in.
The moralizing and the gelatinous ooze that was the actual getting to the action of the meat of the story. What would you say the meat of the story is? Like, what's the call to action if you were diagramming this?
I don't know. I think that was probably another problem for me watching the movie is, like, somewhere in the middle, I was like, what is the plot of this movie? Struggling to feel like there was a driving force for Milo through, you know, it seemed like disconnected scene through from disconnected scene. Like, I think that there was like sort of like a, like they're trying to get to the castle. You know, there's like some sense of like a motivation, like, or like a contrived sense of like they need to do the next thing, like from here to here. But in terms of why any of it actually matters, or like why Milo is doing any one thing or another, I don't know.
I think that's 100% fair. So the toll booth instructs him that he has to pick a destination. He's not allowed to drive through the toll booth until he picks where he wants to go.
Rule number 8A, all travelers must have a destination. No journey is valid without a destination. Find one on your map, Milo.
And so a map pops up in the glove compartment, and he looks at it, and he randomly chooses the castle in the air. And he discovers that once he gets into the world of the Phantom Tollbooth, whenever he says the phrase, the castle in the air, there are lightning flashes and ominous tones of thunder and color changes. The companions that he picks up along the way tell him, no, don't ever say the castle in the air. It alerts the attention of the demons, and we don't want to get them to notice us. So he has chosen as his destination something that is forbidden, and then it still takes, I'm going to say, roughly 45 minutes in order for him to have another reason to go there besides the fact that he basically went boop and picked a place on a map. So the fact that it ends up being the place where he ultimately needs to go in order to fulfill his hero's quest is a coincidence. That's not good plot structure. You're right that isn't a real impetus. He chooses the destination and it happens to be the thing that he needs to go to. He should want to go there for a good reason, or it's too much of a contrived coincidence that it happens to be the same place. There's nothing that indicates that should be the right place to go. Similarly, there's the basic concept of character motivation in fiction that says that a passive character is somebody where everything happens to him. And that most movies are predicated on the idea that you want your hero to be active. And so you want the action to happen because of the things that he or she does. And Milos begins as very passive. Interestingly enough, the movie has adapted him to be more active. So this version of Milo that you get in the Chuck Jones film makes more choices and more decisions. The decision to try and get the king of Dictionopolis and the mathematician of Digitopolis to agree to restore the twin sisters of Rhyme and Reason is Milo's decision in the movie. In the book, the humbug suggests it and then is outraged when somebody listens to him because he's a contrarian by heart. So Milo is along for the ride on that as well. Milo just sort of gets in his motorized car, a thing that all of us, when we were kids, were envious of the rich kids that had the motorized car. It's even worse than Harry Potter, which is the most egregious, terrible example, if I can go on my traditional rant, of the worst kind of, oh no, everything bad has happened to me, but no, I'm secretly the heir to a fortune in gold in Gringotts, and I get a special free broom, and everybody loves me, and I'm the answer to a prophecy. Gosh, it sure is terrible that my parents are dead, but at least everything else in my life is amazing.
I'm very available for this.
Good. Boy, do I hate that first book.
We'll talk after the show.
So it could have been worse. He could have been even more passive, but you're not wrong in feeling that he is a passenger in his own story and that the structure of it is let's have fun with another turn of phrase or another concept and then go on to another one because they're more in service of having fun with language and pointing out absurdities than they are about actually reaching a point. The point of the movie, as you say, is about, hey kids, wouldn't it be great if you thought that things were entertaining instead of being surrounded by a torpor of everybody providing you with entertainment? You need to make your own entertainment by finding out that the world is a complicated and wonderful place that has color in it if only you know how to look for it properly. That's both a thing I agree with and don't necessarily agree with the syrupy way in which it's asked to be taken in doses. That was a terrible sentence, but you know what I'm trying to get.
It's so annoying. It's so annoying. It's like the first rule of writing, like show, don't tell. Mm. And it was only telling. It was so ironic. Like one of the last demons that they run into is like the overbearing know-it-all. And I'm like, ha, ironic.
It's the overbearing know-it-all.
You should have stayed home and minded your own business. You never listened to your betters. I tried to tell you, but oh no. I'm always right about these things.
Oh, that's great. We started off when I did the summary. I sort of said, you know, we get this extended title sequence of Milo trudging past things in the world that could be exciting and that another kid could find interesting. And I felt like there was restraint in not being like any other boy would see the goats and be excited. And we see the other kids playing with the goats and we see a little girl like look at Milo being like, hey, don't you goats? And then she goes back and sort of looks disappointed when he doesn't get excited by it. It's actually maybe too subtle approach to showing that Milo's not engaged in the world around him in the credit sequence. So you do get that kind of show, don't tell aspect there. And then he flops on the couch and gives us 2 minutes of exposition saying, boy, education's boring. I hate memorizing. Which I feel bad about saying is dumb because it's part of the opening of the book. And I love the opening of the book. I love the prose. I like the line, I can't see the point in learning to solve useless problems or subtracting turnips from turnips. And I think that the closing sentence to the third paragraph on the first page, and since nobody bothered to explain otherwise, he regarded the process of seeking knowledge as the greatest waste of time of all. I think that's a legitimate concern in a Google universe, where people don't think that discovery is possible anymore, that everything is finite and you can just search for it. And so if it's that easy and that effortless for me to just have Siri look something up, then it doesn't matter. And when Siri's crap and can't tell me something, I don't care enough to actually make the effort to try and find it out on my own. I think that's a legitimate plague in this country. And so the fact that it was something that was happening in 1970 and in 1961 is very interesting to me.
Well, I think what is interesting about that you're bringing from the book, it contrasts with the movie in that the book points back towards the educators and the school and says, you know, this is like a problem with how they're teaching. You know, like you can't teach like subtracting turnips from turnips and like never talk about like what the point of education is and expect kids to be thrilled. You know, it's not Milo's fault that he's feeling very bored and probably a little bit depressed. You know, he's coming home and flopping on the couch because he's like drained from school. Maybe that's not Milo's problem. Maybe that's like a system level problem. You know, it's like probably of like a modern way of interpreting that. But watching the movie, I think it pushes like the responsibility back on Milo and says like, Milo, like you just love to waste time, Milo. Mm. Like you just don't care. You just don't get it. And I think that like that's sort of like the message watching the movie that I've really responded negatively to is this sense that sort of just really reminded me of being in Catholic school. The sense of like, you're going to memorize your multiplication tables and you're going to love it because that's like the most important thing that you can do. And like this very sort of like regimented sort of like memorization for memorization's sake. And this whole scene where I forget the name of the monster, but the monster is like, you're such a time waster. You just like to unfold paper clips.
But these tasks don't seem very important.
Of course they're not important. If you always do the easy and useless jobs, you'll never have to worry about the important ones.
This is a wonderfully designed, faceless man in a suit. Very elegant, very dapper, but with no wrists, just gloves, and with no neck, just a floating blank head. And he is the terrible Trivium. He is the monster that is just about doing trivial acts that don't mean anything.
Yeah, doodling. And
yeah, and unfolding paperclips really got to me. Like, that one was like, that one hit home. Like, it's not a thing that I do myself, but it's something that I have seen. Like, people just idly clip paperclips together into centuries-long chains in order to not do anything else.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if you have a perspective on this as an educator, but I think that, like, my perspective on this as a person is that, like, we really fail people who have all of this physical energy that's not being channeled. And that part of the message in the movie that I got was this really old-fashioned sense of you need to sit still and you need to be engaged in these ways and you need to learn in these ways. You need to learn about Christopher Columbus and you need to memorize this and you need to never be bored and you need to not unfold paper clips. And I think that 50 years later, probably what you need to do is like be muddy and question authority and be bored and, you know, that there's like a perspective on what it means to be a kid and what education is that was coming across in the messaging that I just think that like probably the values that the author has. I mean, probably.
Well, let's talk about the author very briefly then, because in the documentary in Beyond Expectations, Juster says, I was a very strange child, and teachers and parents didn't know what to do with me. So I was free to wander around on my own and be bored. Mm. And that's what led him to read. And when he read, he didn't understand what words meant, but they were so intriguing, so wonderful, the sounds of them. And so some of the joy of this book comes across because it's about the association with words. Do you know the actual definition of humbug?
No.
So I didn't have a clear thing of this, which is why I have a tab open for it. But Merriam-Webster says that a humbug is something that's willfully false, deceptive, or an insincere person. Oh, and so to have the humbug character in Phantom Tollbooth be an insect who flatters and dissembles and says one thing but doesn't mean it is literally just a personification of the concept with a little bit of a pun thrown in. It's not super sophisticated, but it is clever and it is effective. And it sort of comes out of, I assume, that instinct that Juster has where he read words beyond his capability and then figured out what they meant by context and then created images around them. That's what this book allows people to do.
Well, for a book, I think that you're talking about a lot of really effective things.
Yes.
And I think like even you just reading that first passage was very compelling for me. And I think as a movie, it's not as effective and it didn't work the same way.
And do you think that that is a translation issue, that it's the adaptation of the screenplay? Or is it that you simply, when you take something beyond words on a page and you render it, when you make it real in a visual sense, it's going to bleed some of the cleverness out of it because you're not creating those associations in your head. You're watching somebody else having done that.
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other books that have been translated that have that same like wordplay element. Hitchhiker's Guide comes to mind as something that like is a masterful work as a book, and I thought was very clever as a movie. You know, like I enjoyed the movie a lot. I didn't think that it was not as amazing. is the movie ever? But still managed to land a lot of what it tried to land in terms of the jokes and the material.
I have a couple of quotations from Juster in interviews about the film because he didn't like it.
So interesting. Go on.
Oh, if you could see Hannah's face for this listener, she is here for somebody not liking this movie.
The author himself? Yes. Yeah. Do continue.
The film comes out in 70, having been completed in 1968, but got started on after the success of Chuck Jones at MGM having made the Oscar award-winning animated short The Dot and the Line, a Mathematical Romance, based on a short story, a children's book by Norton Juster. And so The Dot and the Line, which is a great cartoon, very avant-garde, really interestingly compelling 2D animation. It was such a great success, they got the Oscar, that MGM was like, well, this is a good collaboration. Well, what other Juster stuff can we adapt? So they went to Phantom Trollbooth because of that previous successful translation of wordplay into visuals. In an interview with a woman whose pen name is Rose Etta Stone, which I find very difficult to say out loud, despite the fact that I was just saying how much I enjoyed the puns in the Phantom Tollbooth, and an undated interview with MyFavoriteBookshop.com, she asks Juster, you know, wouldn't Phantom Tollbooth be so well suited for animation? And he says, it was a film I never liked. I don't think they did a good job with it. It was well reviewed, which made me angry, but it was never put into general release. It's drivel. And later in the AV Club in 2011 for the 50th anniversary of the book, he says that he liked the Dot and the Line adaptation. He says, I found that some of it was disruptive, but, and this is, I think, crucial, it went over very well, and so I was pleased. I think he was happy because it was successful. Like, he had problems with the adaptation, but he was willing to put that on a back shelf because people were impressed with it. And the Phantom Tollbooth sort of disappeared. It isn't a household word. It isn't a thing that's celebrated as an adaptation, the way in which Chuck Jones' How the Grinch Stole Christmas from 1966 is. He says, I wasn't as pleased with the Phantom Tollbooth. One of the problems was they treated it like the Holy Grail and wouldn't change anything. When you transform a book into a film, you have to be changes. But Jones was too respectful, which I think is an absurd criticism, considering how much has been changed by the book. So Juster's take is that this is a very fealty-oriented adaptation of the book, whereas I can see all these differences. He really wanted there to be a kind of integrated way where when we see him at the beginning, we see things that are representative of the different demons that he has to face. You know, so we'll see people linking paperclips together, we'll see him doing it, or we'll see, you know, all the different fears that he has to face, and then they'll come back around, there'll be manifestations of his inner conflict. Like, he wants it to be a very Hollywood movie, which feels very simplistic to me. It feels like everything he's complaining about the film is not what we're complaining about the film.
No, I think I'm complaining about that too. Like earlier when I was like, well, like, golly, give me a Disney movie, which is not something I ever normally feel. But I think, you know, if you like break apart like your typical Disney movie from a similar time period, you would see like a very tight introduction, like rising action crisis.
I'm really looking forward to our hopeful recap of the Aristocats.
Oh, the Aristocats. Oh, God.
Once we get
Why
to it in
I
December.
Said this? Oh, no.
Because that will be the example of a Disney film from a similar period.
Here's what I think I know about Disney movies. Mm. The way that I feel about Disney movies is that, like, you get introduced to the characters. It starts out, everything is like really nice, right? Like everyone is like really happy.
I'm thinking Beauty and the Beast at the moment. Let's use that as our model because it starts off with Belle in the town and everyone's ring-a-ding-ding happy.
I don't remember. I don't remember Beauty and the Beast that well.
Okay. Little Mermaid, she's in her undersea kingdom. She's got forks. She's a princess. Everything's great.
Yeah. And then there's like some kind of tension that's introduced. And then crisis.
Oh, no. There's a boy.
Right. So
and
it sounds like
he's above water and I'm below water. How do I fix this?
Well, like the most simple Disney plot model is like happy at the beginning, then like some kind of tension introduced, maybe like a family tension, you know, like the inner tension of the protagonist, and then a bigger crisis. You know,
I've given my voice to a sea witch and I'm now running out of time.
And then
I'm going to keep modeling this, even though it's distracting me. I apologize. Because I've never thought about breaking down the Uber Disney plot. So I'm trying to see if it makes sense as you describe it.
And then I feel like at the beginning of the third act, there's like the worst stuff happens. You know, Ursula's like,
haha, now I'm also a sexy land girl.
It has everything. But then like eventually like everything starts to wrap up. And then at the end, everything is happy.
Right.
So the problem that I have with this movie and why I think that the author was right to have some hesitations, although I think that like any writer is going to be distressed about like seeing their book made into a movie, is that the movie is very, it's very episodic. Like it just brings like, like scene after scene, and they're often not really distinguishable from each other. And like we have the doldrums and we have the monster that you said the name of, the Trivium.
The terrible trivium.
Yeah, the terrible trivium, and the green giant, and the demons of ignorance, and after a while, it's just like we get it, and it doesn't have the same. We don't have that driving force from Milo. We don't have that same like nice like that the energizing arc of, you know, like that Disney does like really nicely, where things are like calm at the beginning, everyone's happy, and then there's like some inner tension with the protagonist, crisis, rising action, resolution. We don't have that in this movie. We have like a series of pretty irrelevant scenes meant to illustrate like the moral point of the movie. And like one or two of those is sort of forgivable. Like, okay, the doldrums, like we get it. But strung all together, I think that it's really possible to lose the audience. And I think that that's probably what the author was distressed by.
But all right, so potential counterpoint.
Let's hear it.
So while there isn't necessarily a clear driving action in the three-act structure that you outlined, I definitely agree with that. What we more have is Milo's introduced to a strange new kingdom, goes through a portal into an alternate world where none of the rules apply. And so the first thing you do when you enter into this kind of new world, let's say, for example, like in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is you start to learn all of the new rules of the new kingdom. And you try to figure out what's new and what's different. And so his first interactions are what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, how does this compare? And so it's an extended sequence of saying things are absurd and the power structure here is different. At which point then he's able to say, I've now figured out that it's not just that things are strange, it's that even you who live here are aware that the rules are broken and that things need to get better. How can I help them get better? But he has to figure out first that things are wrong and different and that the people who live there agree with him in order to have the impetus to try and fix them. At which point the second half of the movie is that attempt to right those wrongs and restore, as we've mentioned, rhyme and reason. There is a Disney movie and a classic work of literature that mirrors this structure of the adult world is chaotic and doesn't make sense and only a kid can really notice that all of this is farcical. And that's Alice in Wonderland.
Right, which they totally ripped off. I don't care that he says that he didn't read it. You cannot read something and still rip it off.
Did you read that? Did you find an article where he said that he hadn't read Alice in Wonderland?
Yeah, I read it somewhere. It was probably on Wikipedia.
Yeesh. I hadn't encountered that, but yeah, that's hard to swallow. But in that regard, I think that therefore there is the, I believe it's the picaresque model of literature, which is that you go through a series of comical events. This is the structure of Gulliver's Travels. This is the structure of Don Quixote. Not everything has to be in the 3-to-5-act structure.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair point.
And it makes sense that somebody who comes from animated shorts a series of Looney Tunes cartoons, which Chuck Jones is famous for,
yeah,
would also approach this as a series of sketches. This is basically, not to bring up the other half of this podcast that you don't associate yourself with, kind of like a Monty Python movie or a Saturday Night Live movie or all of those things where they take a sketch and then they try to say, well, here's a joke, here's an idea, okay, it's over, on to the next one. And then we encounter the next city or the next beast in the road or the next thingy that we're then going to point at and go, oh, that's weird, isn't it? Yeah. All right, next.
I think that's really fair. And I really like that read on this. I think if I were in the writer's room, I'd be like, that's the same joke. Take it out.
Mm.
You know, by the fifth or sixth sketch and be like, no, it's like you got to switch it up. Like, it's not hitting.
Yeah, because there is basically two things that he's pointing out, which is that, as you say, the kind of didactic way of being taught that you just have to absorb these things and accept them instead of potentially discovering on your own that they are interesting and compelling is the only way in which to find wonder in the world. And secondly, boy, language is messy, are pretty much the only two things that are being hammered home.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I felt most strongly while I was watching the movie is that the person who wrote the story, who wrote the words of the movie, and the person who illustrated it, who animated it, were having completely different experiences, that the animators probably didn't even know what it was about.
Wow. Okay. Well, then you, to a degree, then agree with Norton Juster in that the, well, not what he says, but what I think he says, which is that they're not approaching the source material from the same perspective.
I mean, the story itself, the words of the movie, like, I think are in some degree responsive to the essence of this. Well, I don't know if it's responsive to the essence of the book or not. Like, I think that you would have to tell me more about that. But the animation itself is beautiful. It's a beautiful movie. And, like, that's what I loved most. It's why I would recommend it to somebody to watch. It's why I think it's a valuable movie in terms of, you know, the history of cinema. The music is beautiful. If you just watched it with the sound off, you know, or without the vocal track, I think you'd be like, wow, what is this movie? This is so cool. But I think, like, adding in the words, you know, and getting all of this moralizing is quite a downer in terms of this sort of, like, sit down, shut up, enjoy education for education's sake, or you're, like, you know, it's like they're like awful ninnies, whoever wrote the script. Like,
yeah, so it's an interesting idea. Is did they think that that was the heart of Juster's novel and they got it wrong? Or did the production of the script turn it into that because that was what they thought needed to be part of children's programming?
Right.
Other people in the documentary talk about the fact that it got published at all was revolutionary because it came out only 4 years after The Cat in the Hat got published. And The Cat in the Hat revolutionized children's publishing in a couple of different ways. Mm. According to the documentary, one of it was, I think it's fairly well understood that The Cat in the Hat and in general the beginner books from the Dr. Seuss stable were written deliberately with very basic repetitive vocabulary so that children could learn it. And apparently that came out of a drive that was connected to the space race. That in the 1950s, we were concerned that our literacy rates were falling behind that of the Soviet Union. And so they were looking to create acceptable ways in which we could increase elementary school literacy and therefore create better scientists so that we could win the Cold War. And so Juster's book doesn't work with that model at all. With its series of complicated adult vocabulary and puns that don't make sense for the first 20 years of your life because you don't know their puns. His book shouldn't have been published in the same landscape as the roaring success that was the Dr. Seuss books. Mm. And so the fact that it was its own small level of a cult phenomenon shows that that kind of pedantic, learning-oriented, reductive approach to children being manipulated into enjoying learning, that they also wanted something else. They wanted something that was about Juster's synesthesia. where he had learning disabilities and therefore was confused by things and turned that into an entertaining series of his own personal experiences with idioms and turns of phrase and things that were silly when you thought about them too hard. Mm-hmm. That is therefore strange that that got turned back into a movie that was about sit down at your desks, appreciate what's being told to you.
Right. Yeah.
Because one of the things that I think is one of the great failings of the movie is that the stuff that Milo comes up with when he needs to smash down the wall to get into Digitopolis.
Can you remember any mathematics?
Let's see. Things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
And when he needs to power the car by thinking in order to get out of the doldrums, are all the things that are in the school montage.
Albert Einstein, E equals MC squared.
William Shakespeare.
Anthony Trollope, Isaac Newton.
Faster, boy, faster. Roger Bacon, John Stuart Mill.
They're all the things that he's been taught.
Right.
They're not inventions. One of the beautiful things about, for example, the Lego movie, which I don't know if you've seen it.
I've not.
Is that the Lego movie is about the tension between people who build Lego sets where just make the thing that's in the instructions and people who see a pile of Lego bricks and are like, oh, this can be anything. And if you're just doing the stuff that's on the box, you're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. You're just therefore being creative. That's in air quotes, listeners, according to what people are telling you is creative. Right. And so to me, one of the great failings of the movie is that Milo's burst of inspiration that learning is grand doesn't come from being in a weird world where he's able to make his own discoveries. It comes from him learning that the stuff that he's been taught in his dull classroom actually has an application.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that goes back to like this weird feeling I got that like whoever wrote this script was having like a really different time than like the people who were animating it. You know?
Yeah, and I just wish I knew if that happened because of Jones, if it happened because of Jones's co-writer, if it happened because of studio interference, because I can see, even in 1970, even 14 years after The Cat in the Hat, mm-hmm. that animation could have lived in a world where they were like, yeah, we need to box this in and package it for kids. And when they said kids, they didn't mean kids. They meant what adults thought kids should have.
Yeah. It's pretty terrible. And like, it makes me sad when like, when you describe like your experience with this book, it sounds pretty magical in terms of like the experiences that one can have with a book as a kid. And like what this movie could have been. Like, I can see why Jester was disappointed.
On that note, let's move on to our second segment of the podcast, which is the excerpted minute quiz. I was unable to, because my access to this film was through the Criterion Channel, to excerpt a clip from it. So instead, I chose a randomly selected minute provided to us by the good people at random.org from the documentary Chuck Jones, Extremes and In-Betweens, A Life in Animation. And so Anna is going to watch random minute 36 from this hour and a half documentary. She will have 30 seconds to summarize what happens in the 60 seconds, at which point she will either get, upon successfully summarizing it, a bonus point as we go into the trivia round, or she will start off on a level playing field as I ask her a series of unanswerable questions.
I'm so excited.
About the content of that clip.
This is my favorite part.
The wonderful thing about animation is that you can choose to do whatever you want to do. You don't have to follow the conventions of real life. So when the coyote is going to start running, for instance, there's a lot of ways you could have him start to run to build up ahead of speed.
Anna, your 30 seconds begins now.
This clip is several film critics talking about the magic of animation and how it allows us to illustrate anything that we might want to do, and how Chuck Jones was a master of flattening his characters and bringing them back to life, and how Chuck Jones would never have
10 seconds left.
Would never have a character stay in one shape for too long.
5 seconds left.
That's it.
Ha 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 ha. All righty.
I've never been one to finish so soon, but
yeah, but you picked an interesting technique, which is you did a summary of the clip instead of describing point by point what happened, and therefore you ended with about 5 seconds to spare. You may have figured a devilish way around my tricky.
I'm gonna try it next time too.
Well, I'd like to say, Ben, that the theme of this clip was sort of about man's inhumanity to man. I think that's 25 seconds left. I don't know why that's my vocal impression of you, but we'll ignore that part. All right. As you say, the critics in that clip talk about how things are compressed and spring back into shape. And so we're going to ask you 5 questions today about cartoon physics and Chuck Jones cartoons.
I got this.
Question number one. Which of the following Looney Tunes characters did Chuck Jones not create? A. Michigan J. Frog. B. Wile E. Coyote. C. The Tasmanian Devil.
Michigan J. Frog.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Tasmanian Devil is the one that he didn't have a hand in creating. He did, however, very much co-create both the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, which are, I'd say, the characters most associated with him. These are rules for the Coyote Roadrunner cartoons established by Jones according to a mural at the Museum of the Moving Image. Of these three, which is not violated in at least one of the Roadrunner cartoons? A. The Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going meep meep. B. No dialogue ever except for meep meep. C. No outside force can harm the coyote. He is only harmed by his own ineptitude or by the failure of the Acme Corporation. And D. The Roadrunner must stay on the road.
The Roadrunner can only say meep meep.
I'm sorry. That's not actually what it says. It says no dialogue ever except for meep meep. Oh, so not the Roadrunner.
That's what I meant.
Okay. No, the coyote actually in a couple of cartoons stops and speaks English. He even talks to kids who are watching the cartoon in a notable exception. But the first one, the Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going meep meep. The Roadrunner never actively tries to hurt the coyote except by startling him by speaking it. That is a consistent rule in all of the cartoons.
Those are so good. It makes me want to watch it again.
Question number 3. Which of the following examples of cartoon physics doesn't appear in the Phantom Tollbooth? A. A character is struck or wounded, but the effects are delayed until it is convenient. B. A character goes through a physical object because there's a trompe l'oeil entrance painted on it. C. A character spins legs for a moment over thin air before falling.
A.
No, the humbug is stung by the spelling bee and then doesn't react for another minute and a half. So that one is in there. Similarly, the humbug, TikTok, and Milo all walk over a pit and then don't fall for a second. But nobody goes through a thing because there's an image of it on a wall.
Oh my gosh.
Question number 4. And here's where they get terrible.
I beg to differ.
Cartoon physics is not the title of what real thing? A. A poem by Nick Flynn from his collection Some Ether, appearing in the National Poetry Foundation's website. B. A book about animation film theory by Duke University Press by Karen Beckman. Or C. A 2015 interdisciplinary exhibit in the Kingston Engholm Museum in Vienna, featuring a Roomba, 2 pink horses, and over 2,000 sci-fi paperbacks.
Okay.
No, it is a poem.
Oh.
It's a frequently sought-after poem. If you search for cartoon physics and hit space, cartoon physics poem is one of the first things that comes up. But cartoon physics is a chapter in a book on animated film theory by Karen Beckman, but not the whole book.
You're a monster. How do you sleep at night?
Lastly, Norton Juster, as we said, didn't think that the film was very good. In part, one of the things he didn't like about it was the mix of live action and animation. he said he would prefer if there was a wholly live-action version. Luckily for him, they're trying to make a remake. Which of the following screenwriters is not attached to the adaptation? A. Michael Vukadovich, known for Kidding with Jim Carrey, the television series on Hulu Runaways, and attached to the unproduced Beetlejuice sequel. B. Alex Tsai, who wrote Watchmen for Zack Snyder and did an early pass on a possible future reboot of The Crow. Or C. Michael McCullers, who wrote Boss Baby and is attached to both the Shrek and Fantastic Four reboots.
C.
Correct! That was just a random guy who also did reboots, and I thought, therefore, was a perfectly reasonable thing.
I just want our listeners to know that you look so shocked when I get one right.
That is embarrassing.
Yeah, it is embarrassing. You need to tone it down.
I didn't realize that subconsciously I had that little faith in you. And I'm truly, truly humbled by that.
Well,
oops.
You do make these purposefully absurd and impossible, so I don't really take it personally.
How do you feel about a possible remake, Anna? Are you on board since you said that the text was misinterpreted before? Do you think that there's room for that in today's environment?
I think that they can do it, you know, and I think it's 2020. I think that we're ready for a woke-ass Phantom Toll Booth. You know, like, let's do some, like, Waldorf education version of what it means to be a kid.
As always, we end each episode with our five favorite moments. A moment is not a full scene or a full sketch. It is a line, a gesture, a small piece of performance, writing, or acting that just makes us think or smile or be transported for a moment. Anna, what's one of your five favorite moments from The Phantom Tollbooth?
One of my very favorite moments is the scene with the conductor conducting the sunset.
That's Chroma the Great, the one same man left in this country.
You mean the one who conducts rainbows and sunrises and sunsets and things?
Right. We're lucky. It looks like he's ready to conduct today's sunset.
What did you like about it?
I thought that there were some very sweet details, like the way that he smooths his hair back before he starts conducting. It's just, like, very quirky. It was also very richly animated. Like, the colors were very beautiful, and the music was very beautiful. It was also very sweet in terms of, like, one of the little vignettes where, like, Milo, like, stops and participates in, like, a very creative moment in terms of how this world was conceived of, sort of reminiscent of maybe of, like, Fantasia or something, but definitely, like, displayed the expertise of the artist.
Interestingly enough, that scene is one of the things that Juster cites that
hates
when he was writing the book and did present it to an editor, they were like, you should take this scene out. It doesn't advance the narrative. It doesn't do anything.
That makes sense.
You should get rid of it. And he was like, no, I like it. I want to keep it. And one of the things that Jones does in the movie is that he turns it into a part of the plot. In the book, Milo ends up conducting a full week of chaotic sky until he's able to accidentally get it back to darkness, at which point he wakes up Chroma, who goes, oh, I guess it's morning again, time to bring up the sun, and doesn't understand that all this has happened in his absence. So it's not something that needs to be fixed because of Milo's hubris. Therefore, rhyme and reason aren't required to put it back to normal. I'm going to say, as one of my favorite moments, it's funny that you say that, I just like the simple gag of the repetition of when Milo conducts the orchestra. He does the exact same things that Chroma does with his arms and with his eyes. He puts his arms up straight in the air, and he looks at one side, and he looks at the other, and he cocks up his eyebrows. I liked both the weird little joke of a little boy watching somebody do something and wanting to do it. He also does the parts that aren't perhaps necessary to doing it, but that's because he's seen somebody else do it. He thinks that they're part of the process. And I also just like that conducting is part of Looney Tunes history. The Rabbit of Seville, which is a famous Bugs Bunny cartoon where a opera tenor is so annoyed with Bugs playing the banjo and the tuba and various other things up on his hill that's distracting him from practicing, that Bugs then pretends to be a conductor and tortures the man in front of a live audience. And there are some great Bugs as conductor, Bugs as severe taskmaster, the way in which he transforms physically into whatever is necessary as his prankster role, that are some of my favorite abrupt combinations of visuals and sound, and the way in which Looney Tunes have that relationship with music that I think are is one of the best Bugs Bunny cartoons. And so this harkened back to that for me, and I liked that mimicry of his past work.
Love it.
This is Future Ben. The cartoon that Past Ben's described in such detail is called Long-Haired Hare from 1949. The 1950 short Rabbit of Seville has Elmer and Bugs stumbling into a live performance of The Barber of Seville.
Welcome to my shop. Let me cut your mop. Let me shave your crop.
And reenacting it.
Daintily, daintily.
What's your third moment for our recap?
I would say I really did love the Terrible Trivium and the moment where he hands the humbug the needle and he's like,
"And you, sir, have the privilege of taking this delicate needle and digging a hole through this cliff."
"Why, thank you, sir. An exacting assignment, quite worthy of my talents."
And the humbug's like, "Sure, I'm on it."
It is interesting how it's the humbug whose character is about saying one thing and meaning another is like game. He's like, yeah.
It was a weirdly compelling scene. Like, as much as I was like sort of annoyed by the moralizing that was still coming through, I found that to be one of the scenes that will probably like stay with me for a long time.
I think that character design, the creepy voice, and even if it's obvious messaging, I think the visuals and the tone of it are effective enough that it overcomes that.
And that his design, like the design of the character, is sort of mirrored off of the humbug, you know, and he like starts off by being like, "Oh, humbug.
That handsome gentleman. I'm so terribly happy to see all of you."
Humbug's like, "To go on," you know, like vain, like responding to it. Yeah, the whole scene was very well done.
For my number four, I want to point out that I thought it was really enjoyable when I discovered that the voice of Ralph on the phone in traditional animation techniques is not the voice of another little boy, but is in fact the voice of a grown woman playing a little boy, much in the way that Nancy Cartwright has played Bart Simpson for over 25 years. The voice of Ralph was the voice of June Foray, who is a legendary animation actress.
Everything seems so impossible.
Who played the part of Granny in Witch Hazel on Looney Tunes, who was Rocket J. Squirrel, who was Cindy Lou Who, and who also plays the terrifying specter of Lena Hyena in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
"I am she, faintly macabre, the not-so-wicked witch."
June Foray is an absolute legend in the animation industry, and I just thought it was hilarious that she was who our boy Eddie Munster was talking to on the other end of the phone. What's your final moment for the collection?
My final moment is probably less a moment, more an element, but I have to say the music. Complicated relationship with the music. This is more of a love-hate. The songs with words I was not a huge fan of, but there's a lot of like sort of like funky lounge music interspersed, and I couldn't get enough.
I thought that the jaunty, fun little bits that happen when he's playing around with the toll booth, where it really starts getting funky, was excellent. That was really a jive, and I agree with you. I think that's part of the disappointment, that once he gets into the animated world and then it doesn't instantly energize the whole film, but like the second thing he does is go to the doldrums, really sapped some of the promise of that particular soundtrack.
Yeah, the soundtrack is a mixed bag, but a lot of it is It was really great.
The stuff that works, works.
Yes.
All right, I just want to close with one conspiracy theory. When the toll booth arrives, one of the things it says to Milo is that
results are not guaranteed, but if not perfectly satisfied, your wasted time will be refunded.
And then when he gets back to the real world, only 5 minutes has passed.
Where have you been for the last 5 minutes?
Where have I been the last 5 minutes? 5 minutes? Ralph, are you crazy?
Instead of the hours and days that he thought had taken place in the cartoon world. Which means that, according to the own rules of the Phantom Tollbooth, everything he did was a waste. Which is borne up by the fact that Ralph then has the toll booth show up in his house.
There's something funny in my bedroom.
Something funny in your bedroom?
Yeah, it's a big box.
Which means that Rhyme and Reason also sent it to him for him to go through the exact same adventure. Which means he didn't go to a mystical world. They're basically competing in some sort of obnoxious educational video game. That just restarts with whoever's playing it.
I really hope that this is the way that they handle the plot for the remake. I think you should probably write to them because conspiracy theories are really having a moment. So
this is my own personal plot hole analysis of this, is that it means that the whole thing that happened was just the Board of Education getting into Milo and manipulating him into being a good little soldier.
Well, that's definitely the vibe, so. Hopefully they'll handle it with a little bit more nuance the next time around.
Farced Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcenamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website. We will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.